Sorry about that. Welcome, everyone, to the regularly scheduled December 7th, 2010 San Luis Coastal School Board meeting. I apologize for the sidebars up here. We're still giddy from our attendance at the California School Boards Association. In closed session, we discussed, review of possible action on appointment, employment, discipline, resignation, and dismissal of a district employee. In closed session, the board discussed a disciplinary issue. The board voted 6-0 to accept the superintendent's recommendation regarding the discipline of employee number 300307. Also, in closed session, there was a conference with labor negotiators, and direction was provided by the board. Okay, and let's see. Consensus on the order of business, everyone? Seeing no one, we'll just stick with the plan. The first item, I always mess this up. Approval of the minutes. And I was absent, so I'll entertain a motion regarding that.
I'll move.
Okay. Oh, there are. Thank you for that, Ellen.
I'll move approval of the revised minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Motion by Mark. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
And any discussion, revisions, changes? Okay. Motion by Mark. Go ahead. Okay. Motion by Mark. Go ahead, Chris.
Hold on just a second. I'm sorry, Kim, I didn't catch this before, but we have Walter as being absent, but then we have an open session on the revised as well.
I was absent, I swear.
The first page of the minute, the corrected minutes of November 16th. We have roll call, and then we have open session. Yes.
All right. Is that amendment acceptable to Mr. Buckman and Mr. Angel? Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? So that'll pass 5-2-1 abstention. 5-0-1. Kim knows what it means. Okay. Presentation by student rep.
November 22nd meetings.
Oh. So. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Phil, for that.
I'll move for approval of the November 22nd
meetings.
I'll second.
I was there.
Okay.
No, I already did. Okay. Any discussion, amendments, changes, anything? Seeing no one, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes 6-0. Thank you. Now we'll move on to student representatives.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, school board members. My name is Francisco Castillo, and I'm a senior at Pacific Beach High School. First item of interest, after the completion of our second marking period, over 80% of our students earned 9 credits, breaking all previous records at Pacific Beach High School. So far this school year, we have graduated 9 students. Our school student government is in the process of organizing a fundraiser for a downtown cleanup day in order to promote environmental responsibilities and raise a fundraiser for a memorial for Oscar Gonzalez at the city's new skate park. We have also started a new social studies program called Project Citizen. In this program, headed by social studies teacher Mr. Ryan Wena, the students will do the following in order to promote civic engagement, research a public policy issue, environmental, evaluate alternative solutions regarding a public policy issue, develop a solution in form of a new public policy, enlist local or state government to adopt proposed policy, develop a portfolio of their own work, and present the project in a hearing before the city's council, state legislator, or district school board, submit the complete project at the annual Project Citizen National Showcase. Also, our mock trial team has already participated in two scrimmages. The third one will be completed Tuesday the 14th against Templeton High School. Finally, our school will be hosting an annual holiday meal for all students and all our guests on Friday the 17th. All of you are also invited to join us. Thank you.
Thank you, Francisco. When do you think you're going to be completed? Because I think you're getting pretty close, aren't you?
Yeah, hopefully by the end of this next month, hopefully.
That's good. Well, we miss you on mock trial, but we do want you to graduate.
Yeah, so
that's
I'm ready
the important
to graduate.
Thing. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Millar?
Yes, Mark, go
Francisco,
ahead.
Francisco, on the 17th, do you have a time?
We don't have a time.
Just show up at 8 in the morning? Okay. Yes. No, Francisco, it's. You want to just tell us? 10:30 would be good.
Well, probably 10:30 to 11.
Okay, I'll see you at 10:30. Okay.
Yeah.
All
see
right.
You.
At PB. Right. Excellent.
Yeah, I wrote down the 14th.
17th.
Yeah.
14th is mock trial. I can't be there on the 17th because I'm going to be doing a real mock trial or an unreal mock trial. I can't. Another mock trial, I guess. But so, and so far, the barbecue and this event have been scheduled when I was gone, so we're going to have to work a little bit on this.
So, go ahead. Next Tuesday, the 14th, we're having our scrimmage against Templeton.
At Templeton.
I think she was wondering.
It's right at 4. It's pretty much right after school, and I can't remember what the name of the teacher, but pardon me?
Scott Lewis.
Scott Lewis, that's right. And it's in their classroom or auditorium. So if you want to come watch, it's worthwhile, and I hear they're getting better and better. So, okay.
Yes, thank right. you.
Thank you, Francisco. Appreciate
yeah,
it.
You're invited to come. Make sure you guys come.
All right.
Mr. Muller.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
I'm sorry. I just got totally confused. I've got Tuesday the 14th, scrimmage versus Templeton.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, and the time on that is?
4 p.m.
4.
At PB.
And the 17th is our annual meal at 11, so.
No, the scrimmage is not at PB.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay,
I'm the cause of the confusion. I'm sorry about that.
I wasn't going to mention that, Walter. So Friday the 17th at PB at what time? That's
10:30.
I can't do that one, but I can do the scrimmage. Okay, thank you.
I'll make sure this gets in our Friday bulletin.
Thank you. So
yeah.
I'm always trying to promote PB events, so I better quit trying so much. Okay. Thanks, Francisco. If you need to head out or anything, feel free. If not, do you want to stick around and enjoy the discussion or join the discussion, too? Okay, next we have the audit report. All right. Julie Lang. Where's my audit report?
Our auditing firm, Vavernick Trine and Day, just recently completed our 2009-10 audit. And I'm very happy to report that there were no findings or recommendations in our audit. And I also want to thank everyone that was involved in doing that. And I want to thank you for moving this up on the agenda because we have a representative from the auditing firm who's going to present this tonight. She just drove up from Rancho Cucamonga and is driving back tonight. So,
with opinions on page 73. So if everybody's there, what we issue is three opinions, one over the financial statements, one over the federal awards, and one over the state awards. In each of the opinions, you had an unqualified opinion, which essentially means you have a clean opinion. On the federal award opinion, we have a list of all the federal programs that we had to test. This year, because of the lovely Aura, The federal government has identified those as high risk. So any program associated with an RO, we had a test. So roughly for your district, we tested roughly 95% of your federal money because of all the RS. So we pretty much covered a good amount, 95%. And for state awards, what the state lists out every year, if you kind of go back a couple of pages on page 70, every year the state issues out a guide that gives us directions as to what programs we need to test. Some years the list changes. Sometimes they stay the same. It really just depends on what the state has identified as problem areas, areas where they found noncompliance in several districts. So we wait out for that guide to come out, and we test all the programs based on what the state directs us to. And, yes?
Emphasize something to the board. It was an epiphany for me many, many years ago, but ultimately the board hires auditors to do two things, one of which they're aware of and the other one is something that you're not aware of probably. First of all, you want the auditors to check on the transactions that you've approved and verify their truthfulness and how they're presented, make sure it's good. But the subterranean purpose of the auditors is that they act as agents of the state and the federal government to verify that the conditions under which we receive money from those agencies is being adhered to. So the state will issue what they call an audit guide each year, and it picks the areas of emphasis that they want auditors to look at to verify what we're doing is correct for the money we received. And I think that's an important piece for you to understand. When you start thinking about how you're spending Title I money, when you start thinking about any of the state programs, class size reductions, or any of them, ultimately it's the auditor's responsibility to verify that what we're doing with that money is appropriate and the amount of money we receive is appropriate. So That's one of their functions.
And I think it's very important to remember that if we are testing programs, and considering the size of this district and how much money you guys get, if we were to, let's say, find an expense that we considered unallowed under the program, what happens is we will then issue out an opinion stating, yes, we found an error and we're saying it's disallowed. What that does is that it gives the federal government a reason to trigger an audit. And then what the next step will be is they would determine whether it is the first time to the degree of the finding itself, and they will then decide if they need to come in and do an audit themselves on the particular program. Usually when federal audits come in, they normally hit a department. So they will hit the Department of Education and the Department of Agriculture, not just Title I. So that's why we want to make sure that all the procedures are in place when it comes to federal programs, because of the fact that a lot of districts have been hit, considering that they have no money, and they see these federal monies available, they start using them, and then we come out and saying, well, you can't use it that way. We issue out a report, and it triggers an audit. So that's why it's very important that with any federal money and with state money, that you use it according to what it was designed to be used for, not we have this pool of money, let's go ahead and use it. So that's what we do when we look at federal funds, the recording of it, if it's being recorded in the right resource. That's part of our audit as well. And we have to give an opinion over that aspect to the government. So that's part of the report itself. The last thing I want to talk about is on page 56. And really, this is just a snapshot of the general fund for the district. So within the general fund, it just gives a really really summarized snapshot of all the revenue and the expenses, and it shows the ending balance and what's available. And what we like to see is a percentage. And although it is fairly high, but for the size of the districts, we like to see that healthier, realizing that those cuts, you still have the same expenditures if no cuts are done at the district. So you're really looking at the fund balance to see how much absorption you can take within the cuts. So that's what we really like to see, especially in these coming up years where we see a lot of districts not being able to meet 3-year obligations. So And really quick, that's pretty much it for our report. You have no findings, so I have nothing to report. I'm not sure if anybody has any questions.
I do. Was in another section
okay. Here,
and I'm trying to find it. The board's been very focused on making sure we fund GASB 45 for our post-retirement and benefits, and I just wanted to make sure I understood the language that you also review the assumptions that we make in determining how we should go about funding something, say the post-retirement funds. And as I understood your report, the actuarial assumptions and other assumptions that we're making in the way that we're financing that obligation is reasonable and appropriate.
Yes. I mean, with you guys, I know you guys are funding it, but you guys are putting it in a fund and not in an irrevocable trust. So
right. When
it comes down to the actuarial, we can't necessarily show what's being held in that particular fund as funding the actuarial. But we do note during our audit that is the purpose of the particular fund. So we do track the money that's going into the fund, how much is being contributed within the fund, and so forth. So when we're looking at it as a whole, we do consider it, but when it comes down to the financials of it, we can't necessarily put that amount and net it against the actuarial, the liability itself.
Unless it was irrevocable.
Unless it was an irrevocable trust, yes.
Good. Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions, Mark?
Yes, thank you. I don't think these will be necessarily related to the audit, but you did provoke some thoughts in here. So as I look at page 11 and we go down the arrows, it would be the 1, 2, 3, 4th arrow from the bottom. This county schools facility funds, I haven't really heard of that before and didn't know that we were paying for the welding shop outside of our own funding. And so I didn't know whether you can answer that or...
I think that's more of a Russell question as far as what is being designated to be used.
This is actually a grant, I think it's a grant, that we applied for back in 2006, 2007.
Okay.
And I think it's part of Prop 1D, and they pulled it back, and then they were going to give it to us, and they pulled it back again, and then it just kind of magically appeared last year.
Okay.
So we were able to use this money, and we have to match it with our own funds.
Okay. So there's more magic money out there?
I don't think so.
We hope. And then I just had one other, and again, thank you so much, because this just provokes some thoughts. When I looked at page 9 and the pie charts, I found it very interesting that on our property taxes, we're bringing in 75% of our funding is coming in through property taxes, and we're spending 80% on instruction related. And I know there's probably nothing that holds those two together, but I just thought it was a great comment on the district.
Yeah, I mean, I did a comparison. What I did is Julie actually asked me a question, how you guys are versus statewide. Unfortunately, I couldn't get the data fast enough to do it, but what I did do is compare it to the school districts that we audit around the area. So I have roughly two other districts that are spending about 60% of their money on instruction, while you guys are at 67. So you guys are fairly higher. The other schools are a little bit smaller, so that's the problem, is that you can't really compare it because of the amount of schools that you have and so forth. But we did realize that you guys do spend a little more as far as percentage-wise on instruction, so that does say a lot of good things about the district.
I'm glad I asked that question. Thank you.
Going back to page 56, where it says long-term obligations, where we previously had long-term obligations, but it says not applicable in 2011. Is that the GASB that we're talking about, retiring that obligation?
No, the MA is really because of the fact that we can't anticipate what kind of liabilities you will have in the future. So we tend to not do a budget on the future You do have a budget based on expenditures, just on the long-term debt that you will have or that you do have now. But we can't do a forecast on the long-term debt that you may have in the future. So that's why we don't include it. Where you would see it really is on the comparison between budget amount versus actual on page 45. That kind of gives you an idea as far as how...
Final comment. I direct your attention to page 74. Now, this is in recognition of Julie's efforts and her staff. And what you're going to find on the next three pages is the word none reported. And this is a rare occurrence in school districts to make it through an audit without some sort of findings or exceptions within the audit report. This is the second year in a row that we've accomplished a zero exceptions or findings audit report. And on page 77, summary of prior year's audits adjustments, none reported. So I just want to recognize Julie and her staff's efforts, and the compilation of the audit report verifies the excellence of their work. So thanks to Julie and her staff.
Thank you. Thank you. Once we got that ASB cash thing under control, it's been a blast since then. Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation.
You.
We appreciate it. Okay. And next we have the election of president and clerk. Is it that I'm ready. I'm ready to be.
I would like out to nominate Chris Unger for the position of president.
Oh. I'll second that.
Any investigative research, any reports or anything? Or do we have any discussion? There was. Okay. Well, I think that's an excellent recommendation. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Passes 6-0. Pass the gavel. Pass the bet. You get rid of it right away and give it to Chris.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, I appreciate the confidence of my fellow board members, and I will do my very best to make sure that we do what we need to do and move on. Next, we need to elect a clerk, so I will accept nominations for clerk.
I'd like to nominate Phil Angel.
I will accept. Thank you.
I think we need a second first, Phil.
Okay, so it's been moved by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mr. Millar to elect Mr. Angel as clerk. Any discussion?
I only seconded it because he wouldn't have to change seats.
I didn't want to have to change seats.
Seeing no discussion, we'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 6-0. Yay, Phil. Dr. Prater.
Well, as tradition would have it, the outgoing president is acknowledged, and I'd like to start by saying that, Walt, I felt you were an outstanding president, especially to a new superintendent in San Luis Coastal, and you were an extremely valued mentor and person that I relied on for guidance and support, and I appreciate the short time we had together as president and superintendent. I appreciate that. Well, there's this... Oh, okay. Come forward, Walter. I would like to honor you with this gavel. And look, it has your name on it.
As some of you are aware, maybe all of you are aware, we're a tiny school, and we don't only participate in the county mock trial competition against schools two or three times our size. We compete. And in order to compete, we need to have the outfit. And so this outfit will be in perpetuity. It'll be the Walt Millar honorary jacket that our attorneys will wear. So thank you so much, Walt.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It means a lot to me. I'll just take a couple moments to say that it's been an amazing year. We saw a terrific gentleman and superintendent go to his just reward. At least till January, he's going to start teaching again. And we were able to come together as a board, and Catherine Heisendrath Rogers as well, in select a really terrific superintendent who I believe will lead this district into our next phase, which is to really do more to boost student achievement, to work with kids like this who are just terrific. I get so much enjoyment out of being involved in PB and mock trial and working with kids like this. And it's just been terrific. And I'm very excited about our future, and I'm looking forward to at least the next 2 years. And I appreciate my board members' support. I had a lot of schedule problems every once in a while, and the board came together, backed me up. Catherine was terrific as clerk. I miss her. And I thank you all for this acknowledgement. Now let's get back to work. Okay.
All right, let's move on then to item number 3, established meeting dates. Dr. Prater.
I think part of the task at hand today is to discern what our meeting dates for the next calendar year will look like. And attached are the proposed dates for the board meetings. If you turn the page, you can kind of see that colored version of what it might look like beginning in January. And our recommendations for those meetings are in blue.
So do we need a motion to accept this? Somebody like to, do we have any discussion on this?
Yeah, I'm
Mr. Buckman.
Yeah. It says proposed at the top, and then we've got, so the, just for the record, the red squares are holidays, is that? And the blue squares are the meeting dates.
The blue squares are the meeting dates.
Thank you.
The solid red squares are holidays. Okay. The red outlines are what? School breaks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Chris, I'd like to move for approval of the calendar.
Moved us. Looking for a second? It's been moved by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mr. Angel. Any other discussion? Anybody from the audience? Seeing no one. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Okay, let's do next. We'll move on to item number 4. Dr. Prater again.
Yes, and here it's the deciding on the appointments to the Central California Schools Financing Authority. Presently, that's Phil Angel. Also, SLO County School Boards Association, and that presently is Catherine Heisendrath Rogers. we need to nominate someone to this Santa Lucia Regional Occupational Program, as well as the interest-based bargaining liaison.
So first thing, I think we'll start with Central California Schools Financing Authority. Currently, Mr. Angel is doing it.
Could I inquire of Mr. Miller how, or Mr. Angel, having been a representative to this some years ago, it was a very short meeting, and I just wanted to have the board members know what they're getting into if they volunteer for this job. So.
The tradition continues, but I think we have not had a meeting that lasted greater than 6.5 minutes, and most of the 6.5 were jokes between Lucia Marr and us. But it does carry a weighty responsibility because it's a lot of money. So it represents the property tax revenues that are derived from Price Canyon oil fields, and the district and Lucia Marr have entered into a JPA to administer to that revenue, and that's the purposes of CCSFA.
Will this be even more important if the development in Price Canyon happens?
Actually, yes. Well,
Mrs. Sheffer, you're interested in doing that? Is there anybody else that has an interest in this one?
I'd like to nominate Mrs. Sheffer to fill this this
do
role.
Do we need to take votes on these individually, or we can just appoint?
I still nominate them.
Okay, so let's appoint Mrs. Sheffer to the Central California School Financing Authority. The SLO County School Boards Association. Do we have anyone interested in that?
I will volunteer for that. Is this where the meeting used to be held in the Madonna Inn by the piano?
Yes.
Okay. I volunteer for this one.
Okay. So is there anyone else who would like to volunteer for this? Seeing no one, we'll appoint Mr. Millar to the SLO County School Boards Association. The Santa Lucia Regional Occupational Program, it's currently held by Mr. Buckman. And I know, Mark, you have a real interest in continuing that. I would support that.
I support that.
I would support that.
Okay. And then our alternate, Mr. Angel has been our alternate.
Continues. They're staggered terms. So only Mark's term needs to be filled.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. So we'll appoint Mr. Buckman then to the Santa Lucia Regional Occupational Program. Our interest-based bargaining liaisons, currently Mr. Angel for CSEA. Is there anyone that would like to move into that space?
I'd like to continue since I haven't really started it yet.
Great. So Mr. Angel will continue into that. And Mrs. Roger, are you willing to continue in SIU?
I'd love to continue
Perfect.
In SIU.
And I know that they would like to have you too. So we'll continue with Mrs. Roger in SEIU. And I believe that's it. Okay. Well, actually, we're moving on to public comment. And then did I miss correspondence? Okay. So for correspondence, the board did receive an email from Mrs. Julie Tacker in Los Osos regarding the solar energy project. Moving on to public comment, is there anyone from the public who would like to address the board on an item that relates to the school district's mission or anything like that? Seeing no one, we'll close public comment. Move on to superintendent's updates. Dr. Prater.
We have two scheduled presentations tonight, just brief reports, one for energy savings and the other for student discipline data review, along with the A through G requirements. And I'd like to begin with the energy savings presentation by our director, Jeff Guy.
Thank you very much. Stash my water there. Is this too loud? Doesn't sound like. Sounds like it's echoing to me. Good evening. Welcome to the seat there, Mr. Unger. Thank you for your work, members of the district. My name is Jeff Guy. I'm the Director of Facilities and Operations and Transportation, and I'm going to be speaking about our energy conservation. So, fired up here. We'll start with the first slide. Energy saving improvements since the late 80s to present. Clicker.
Well, there's room.
There we go. Retrofitting indoor lighting incandescent bulbs to fluorescent. What's important about that? We have 1,230,000 square feet of buildings. It is blanketed with light. Pretty much every square inch has some light on it. Fluorescent lights use 75% less energy than incandescent. Tremendous savings, unburdened a great deal of power that was actually used for modernization and our Measure A to provide power to computers, technology, and cooling. There was a good savings there. It was a two-phase project. We had first inductive ballasts for fluorescent lighting, and then we went to the electronic ballasts with fluorescent lighting. And the electronic ballasts are 10% more efficient. It was worth retrofitting again because of the enormous square footage we have for lighting. Installation of HVAC time clock controls. We had mechanical clocks. These are digital clocks, programmable. We can program out the weekends. We can program out the breaks. We can program out the holidays. Mechanical clocks didn't quite have that flexibility and saves a great deal of labor as well. We don't have to fly around to the 400 clocks or so that we have. Installation of exterior lighting time clock controls. I'd like to go back to HVAC time clocks, actually. We start our heating and ventilation at 7 o'clock in the morning. It's turned off at 3:30. So the rest of the day, we have bypass timers for actuating heat if student. As the outside temperature warms up, it will bring in more ventilation to the point where it's all ventilation. We don't have a lot of air conditioning in the district, which is an enormous savings. We also have the fortunate environment of 50 to 75 degree weather. It's pretty gracious. Not a huge demand on heating or air conditioning. Installation of multi-level lighting, and we have day lighting. A number of our sites have lighting that comes on in the back of the room, the front of the room, or you can have half of the lighting on if necessary. You don't have to have all the lighting on. With day lighting, a lot of our older schools have enormous banks of windows, which could be thought of as a heat or cooling loss gain, but it also harvests a great deal of light. Natural light is a wonderful thing, and because our temperature is being so moderate, heating and cooling is kind of the beginning of the day and the end of the day for cooling. Installation of energy efficient heaters and appliances. Any appliances we buy are Energy Star, and during Measure A and modernization, we eliminated boiler loops. Boiler loops, they continue to heat hot water pipes. They're circulating through the entire campus. They're hot all the time until someone calls for heat, but it's pumping water and it's moving hot water, millions of BTUs to keep that going. We went to individually forced air heaters per room, and so it's heating by the time clock. It's warm when they get in, but it's on demand. You can have the heat on or off. And there's no gas burning if that heater's not operating. Replace exit lights with LED. We're saving maybe 8 watts there, but everything adds up, and it's just another piece of fruit to harvest. I'm not advancing forward. Okay. Estimated annual savings with this particular piece is $350,000. There we go. Well systems and recycled water for turf and planter areas. Morro Bay High School took a great deal of administrative work. Over time, the city of Morro Bay agreed to drill wells on our property, provide that well water for our irrigation use on our fields. We have 14 acres of turf out there, and using the well water unburdens the water for domestic use within the community. The amount of water unburdened to the community is 34 acre feet. It's It's a pretty big pond. San Luis High School, those wells went in probably in 96. Morro Bay High School was 2007. The San Luis High School wells produce 100,000 gallons a night. It's just a great savings for irrigation. Pacific Beach High School's had a well system since 1992, since the school was put into place for our turf areas. That saves about 4 acre feet. San Luis High is about 27 acre feet of water. Laguna Middle School, we have recycled water. It's a $12,000 savings, and it unburdens about 24 acre feet into the community.
Is that part of the city's tertiary system?
Yes, it is.
And I know that in some locations that tertiary water has caused some landscaping issues because of salts. And is that an issue that we
have not experienced that as yet. I've heard of what you're concerned about.
Yeah, across the street at Laguna Golf Course, they apparently had some tough lessons to learn.
And Garcia Fields, I believe,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
We've taken a soil sample as a base reading so we can have a determination later if it's a contribution of the water from where it was before.
Excellent.
Okay. Total estimated annual savings is $350,000. Energy Conservation Rewards Program. This is interesting as well. We were approached by an energy management firm that claimed that they could save us a great deal of money through evaluating our energy use, as well as having a person be on board as an employee, in a sense. We would pay for them. And they would, through education, motivation, and inspections, capture $400,000 a year in energy. Our bills, that's nearly half of our bill. It's pretty optimistic, and we've done all these other items. And their claim was just with that person inspecting and motivating and educating that they could capture that much savings. See the rate that we're paying?
Jeff.
And then you can see what they've saved.
Question?
Yes.
In going through this earlier, I noticed that Baywood, I think it was Baywood, Laguna Middle School, and Pacific Beach had done exceptionally well in cutting their energy use.
Yes.
Have we asked the people at those three sites, Jeff or Russell, what they're doing so that it can be replicated at other sites?
I have. I didn't get a lot of detail. I think in some cases they're not sure. In some cases, there is a concerted effort where they make an effort to turn off lights, turn off their computers. They notify us with our work order system about heaters that might be running that shouldn't be, and they're just more attentive to what's going on with energy on their site. Some of the sites that are pretty close, I mean, you know, it's not too far off. It might be that there's just not that much more to capture, which may not seem fair to others. You know, others get more money than others don't.
Okay. Well, I just thought it was interesting that they had done so well, and now that I look at it, I see Monarch Grove also.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's really just a few that haven't been able to capture it, and we'll work with them on an education program and maybe evaluate their sites more closely as to what they are doing and what they're not doing.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. What impact has that solar panel that was installed at Pacheco had?
It's nominal. It's really more of an example.
Okay.
It's an educational tool.
Right. Okay.
This is their gas therm usage. We don't use as much gas as we do electricity, and the cost is a little different. It's more of a seasonal use, and it's just a little bit in the morning where lights are on all day. So you can see that the difference in savings is not quite as substantial. It has a lot to do with our moderate temperatures. Annual energy conservation. I need to stand over here, I think I'm in the way. Total estimated annual cost avoidance combined from energy conservation improvements, $690,000. Since we've started the program. Very pleased with that, and there's room for more. There's plenty to do. Future steps for additional savings. Solar energy, 3 million in 20 years. I can speak to that. It's a conservative baseline. I haven't portrayed all the scenarios that are affected by the rate of electricity at the time. It's a discussion point as a conservative baseline in this particular example. Retrofit of gym multipurpose lighting to LED. We currently have high-pressure sodium lights in there. They're 250 watts to 460 watts. LED uses 75% less wattage. Substantial energy savings. There's a lot of room there. LED lights are still kind of expensive, but they have about a 2.5-year payback, which is substantial. And then essentially you're saving $6,000 a year in 2.5 years.
Jeff, on the LEDs as opposed to the sodium, more often in the high school and in the in those rooms, and somebody will go, turn the lights off, and they'll turn them on, and then it's like 5-10 minutes to get the light back on.
Correct. It's arc lighting. It does take time for the electrons to excite the atoms to the point where it's luminous. So there's that lag there. LED lights, I'm glad you brought that up, is on and off. It's instant, which is much more user-friendly. It would work in our multipurpose rooms and our gyms in the same fashion.
And then one other question. On the computer management system, I talked to Russell today. Is this the software that allows IT to turn on and off computers remotely?
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody,
I can speak to that
thank you.
Get to that point. Retrofit outside lighting to LED. Capture about $4,000. We don't have as many. They're not on as long. It's dusk until 11:30, so there's some variation there. LED lights are promising for the replacement of our high-pressure sodium lights that we have in place, which was actually an energy conservation move at that time.
Jeff, what's the life span of these LED lights?
LED lights have a 50,000-hour life. This estimation is based on a 15-hour-a-day operation time, 200 days out of the year. The assumption being most of the gyms just turn the lights on and leave them on. Not in all cases, but there's something going on throughout the whole day. With the LED, they could turn them off and on with their use. That would save additional money, but this particular model is based on 15 hours of use a day. We do have one irrigation specialist who tries to get around and manage all that. So it gets a little challenging at times, but he's diligent. And we're looking to save more money with better management there. The computer management system to turn off computer after hours. It's expected that we could capture about 30% of the computer energy. There's estimated amounts of what computers get left on a given day throughout the year and through the weekend. And we have currently captured the software on a 5-year license at no cost through rebates. And we'll be evaluating the savings with the information that they give us to manage. It knows how many computers are on. It knows how long they're on. It's kind of like Santa Claus. It knows which ones are sleeping. And we can turn them on and off as with the program as well.
And that okay, that's the.
So
I think that's the piece I wanted to understand.
Sure. So for example, we can have the computers come on at 7 o'clock in the morning. You can still log on at any time. It just turns itself off. If we could determine that we want all the computers to turn off at 6 p.m., then they turn off. There'll be alerts that say your computer will be turned off in some format, and it'll be turned off. That doesn't mean you can't go back in. It doesn't mean it's not accessible. It just won't remain on. We'll know more about what is actually we can actually capture in time.
Yeah, Jeff,
yes.
I think you may have just solved a great debate, a long-running debate at my house between my husband and my son over whether it's more energy efficient to just leave the computer on or turn it on and off. My son's contention always was that it took more energy to boot it up again than just to leave it.
Nope. You are correct.
Well, I'm not in the debate. My husband is correct that it should be turned on
turn it off
when not in use.
Absolutely. You leave the computer on, it's about $25 to $75 a year. You turn it off, you're consuming no energy. So the less runtime, the less watts burn, the less energy.
I think Jesse's
contention
takes more of his energy to turn
it off. You may be right there.
What about wear and tear on the computer? Where's Amelia? See,
off is good. It means less wear and tear. It also draws less energy from our main servers and the server rooms. It just less heat load. It's really, it can be a very productive capture of money there.
Jeff?
We'll know more as time goes on.
You wrote 30% of computer energy consumption reduction. Mm-hmm. Given our size of our district, number of computers, what's a rough ballpark estimate for what the annual savings would be by implementing this?
That 30% represents, of our 2,400 computers, about 800 of them possibly being left on. It's about $60,000 to $80,000 a year.
Thank you.
Yeah. Substantial. And the software was no cost. We captured it through rebates.
I had a question. With the retrofitting the lights, and you were talking about because they last so much longer,
yes.
So the annual $32,000, that doesn't reflect, or does it, the labor costs involved in replacing the other lights?
It does.
Okay, so the $32,000 includes isn't
captures
just
some labor
on the electric bill. It's also it includes the cost, the
yes.
labor savings.
Just a okay. little bit. There's not a lot of labor to it. To replace an existing lamp, but that has high pressure sodium and a ballast, we would be disconnecting the ballast and essentially screwing this bulb in directly, which is pretty time. Thrifty. Replacement of that system that's in place now is about $140. These lights are $375 a piece to $675 a piece. Some is a full fixture, some is just a lamp. So the scenarios are a little different depending on which gym and which light. So that's an conservative estimate there.
Okay. Thank you.
Look how wasteful I was with the energy. I just
yeah, put that on dim, would you? continue to capture rebates for energy saving retrofits. We get about 10 to 30% savings of a project cost when we do that through PG&E and other type programs. Additional saving opportunities. Install HVAC controls for doors left open with systems in operation. Never seen that before, huh? I don't like punching holes in roofs. they don't leak. I like that. But it's exceptional lighting, and it could provide substantial savings. It's not for every place. And they do have systems that are switched for blacking them out, which has been a problem at Del Mar because you can't turn them off. Yet they have to have an off system, which could add to cost. And I'm estimating it's about $600 a room to do that for 1,000 square feet. I haven't done all the homework involved to where it would apply and where it would suit best, but there are certainly buildings in our district that it would work. Replace fleet vehicles with high fuel efficiency type. It's a pretty obvious direction to go. We don't need to use just gasoline. There's going to be efficient diesel vehicles that are coming through. We have electric vehicles in the future. We would look to replace existing fleet vehicles where applicable with something a little more contemporary.
Chris? Okay, I'm sorry.
Question?
Jeff?
Yes.
When we look at replacing fleet vehicles, sometimes in organizations they actually replace the fleet. Is that a practice that we do, or are we just doing ones and twosies?
If we're fortunate, we would have replaced one a year, and that has not been the case. We replace on as-needed basis. We had, in 2000, a pretty good fleet turnover. Most of our vehicles go from 2000 up. We have some from 90s as well. Okay. So we don't have that luxury necessarily.
It's the year 2000.
Yes.
Not the number of vehicles.
Right. So what we'll actually be able, that means we'll be able to take advantage of the increased energy savings because we'll be buying them one at a time.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
I clicked two there. Hold on. Proceed toward paperless communications. It's a good idea. Less paper mass, less storage, less files. Continue to improve on energy conservation awareness, the education, motivation, and inspection. And ultimately, the very best conservation is the off position. Turn it off. There's nothing better. If you're not in the room, turn the light off. If it doesn't have a motion sensor, if you're not at your computer, it's the end of the day, turn it off. If you don't need heat, put it to vent. Don't take it all for granted. It's about the culture of awareness there. And that concludes my presentation.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Guy. And, you know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars here. I think, Mark, you had asked the question originally how much we're saving. And so it looks to be like we're saving about at least $365,000 a year based on your projections. And
about 690.
Did I say that? 690.
And that's a conservative estimate.
Yeah. Perfect. So, yeah. We're doing well, and it sounds like we could be doing better. So thank you.
Yes. Okay. We'll move forward with it. Any more questions?
Jeff, thank you.
You're welcome.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to talk about this? Okay. Mr. Robinette.
All right. We'll follow with PowerPoint 2 here. And the microphone. Is there a pointer on this thing?
Yes, the little button.
Oh, look at that. I've always wanted a pointer. Okay, thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about some data. We've been trying to become a more data-rich culture in our school district, and I know we've had a few board members asking about our discipline data and our demographics. I know Mrs. Sheffer has had some queries about that. Mr. Buckman, Dr. Eisenrath Rogers, when she was on the board, kind of wanted us to take a look at what is our suspension and expulsion rates? What is it saying about student groups and ethnicity and what have you? So the query I have here is, are there any trends with regard to ethnicity, language ability, special education status, et cetera, as it relates to suspensions and expulsions in our school district? And one of the unfortunate things is that we really only have one reliable year of data to look at, last year. And I say that with some, we can go back years and years and look at data, but the reliability of it, because of where it is stored, is questionable. And it would probably take a ton of staff work, and if you direct me to do that, we can do that. But the questions are good ones. And so what I'd like to do is share with you what we know as of right now. So if we look at our district demographics, just our general district demographics, and I took some liberties in not trying to include every single ethnic group that we report in our district, but let me see if I can get that. There we go. So we have 64% of our population as of last year is Caucasian, is white. 25% of our population is Hispanic, and that's a growing number. We know it's going to grow between this year and the next several years, because our elementary school level, we have about 27% Hispanic, and excuse me, and at the high school level, it's about 21%. So we know that that number is going to go up. I reported the some of the other ethnic groups and kind of lumped a bunch into that multiple and other, and part of the reason is because when we start talking about statistics related to ethnicity, we have to talk about statistical significance. Some of our populations are so low that they are statistically insignificant at any of our schools. And in fact, when we report our data, and when we get our reports back from the state, we only really have two statistically significant subgroups from an ethnic standpoint in any of our schools, and just district-wide, which is white and Hispanic or Latino. But I actually put the little 1% African-American because I want to illustrate something a little farther down the road here. So another, and ask questions if you have them. Another, you know, kind of subset of our district demographics are EL students and special education students. And as of last year, we had 11% EL students and 9% special ed students. That EL population is growing and probably will continue to grow. That's what our expectation is. The special ed population has been, I think, pretty stable over the years, right about at that 9%. So when we look at some other charts, if you can please kind of remember those, some basic numbers. About 64% of our population is white, a quarter of our population Hispanic. Roughly 1 out of 10 students are either an EL student or a special ed student. Okay? So let's look at some discipline data. So first took a look at single suspensions from last year. These are students who got in trouble one time that led to a suspension. Maybe they got in trouble many times, but they were suspended once over the course of the school year. That suspension may have been an in-house suspension, so it could have been an official suspension, but they stayed at school. It could have been an out-of-school suspension. It could have been a multiple-day suspension, but it was one incident. Across the top, we have those ethnic groups on the side right there. Let me see. Use that pointer. We have the elementary, middle, high school. And if you look at kind of everything on that chart, there's not a lot of surprises, except when you look at that Hispanic subset. Remember, about 25% of our student population is Hispanic, Latino, and yet the rates of single suspensions is a little bit higher. Statistically significant, maybe not, but it's certainly a slightly higher trend there. Look at more than one suspension. So these are our recidivists, if you will. These are students who, in the course of 1 year, were suspended more than one time. Had to be out of school or serve an in-house suspension more than once. There's a couple that, you know, when you first eyeball this thing, there's a couple things that kind of stand out. Again, if you look at Hispanic students right there, at the high school level, we now had 43% of the suspensions that were more than one day were Hispanic Latino students. So considerably higher than the overall demographic. I put this African American one where you see these numbers that are much higher, 11%, 8%, to really illustrate the danger of statistics. Because remember, we have 1% of our population African American in the school district, about 50 kids. Maybe 60 kids. So it's a very small number. And so it might seem really alarming when we say, but 11% of the suspensions at the elementary school level are African-American students. Well, that's really talking about 3 kids. And so we have to be really careful when it's, as Mark Twain said, there are 3 kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. So we have to be really careful about, reading too much into statistics. Especially with very, very small subgroups. If I can digress a moment, when I was the assistant principal at San Luis Obispo High School about 15 years ago, I remember getting a call from the Education Testing Service, I think it was, or the College Board, or one of those groups, because they wanted to bestow a special award upon the school for the work that they had done in progressing African-American students in their high achievement. These are actual students who were expelled, okay, Not those that came forward for expulsion hearings.
Thank you.
Were these also where we had suspended expulsions, or are these actual expulsions on the community school?
These are actual expulsions, I believe. Is that what we reported on the civil rights data? Yeah, actual expulsions. So the number, again, is very small. But if you look at the trends here, or at least I shouldn't say a trend, if you look at the data, you see that exactly 2/3 of the students that that faced expulsion were Hispanic Latino students. So much, much higher proportion. Is it statistically significant? Probably by itself, but is that something that would hold over a trend? I mean, this is certainly something to look at over many years to say, do we have that trend of expelling this ethnic group more than any others? That would be something for us to look at. Yes?
Well, you know, that previous slide, it got to 48% for Hispanic students at the high school level. And so I guess my question is, there's something about the high school experience for both Hispanic and EL students that could be a contributor to these higher numbers, setting aside the argument about statistical significance for the moment. Mm-hmm. Because I'm assuming in our percentage of Hispanic students, we have EL students are included in that group.
Well, let me get to the next one, and then we can get back to that. So I did want to also break down EL students and special education students with the same categories, because there is likely an overlap in any of these categories, likely an overlap in some cases with EL students and Hispanic students, but not necessarily. So if we take a look at those subsets differently, we also get some interesting data. What I was surprised about was when you look at special ed. It's, again, single suspensions, one incident. 35% of the suspensions at the elementary school level were special education students. Now, some of these are in-house suspensions. They're not necessarily suspensions away of school. But remember, about 1 in 10 of our students, 9% of our students are special ed students. So it's a pretty high rate. If you look at the more than one suspension, over half of the elementary school suspensions are special education students as of last year in our school district. Now, that number is 35 students. There was 35 students district-wide that had a more than one suspension, but 18 of those students were special education students. And then getting to what you're talking about, Mr. Millar, if you look at the EL population, it is also, about the same as the Hispanic population, but obviously, you know, again, 1 in 10 of our students are EL students, and this is a higher proportion of EL students that are facing suspension at the middle and high school level. We had one student who was classified as an EL student expelled last year. No special education students expelled, and of course, our expulsions have all been at the middle and high school level. Question.
Well, Rick, or maybe Jackie Kirk Martinez could answer this. Would you have any reason to think that the high percentage of special ed students here could be ADHD and impulse control issues, particularly at the elementary?
Well, I think we'd have Jackie might be able to speak to it, but I think we'd have to look at our ED classes. And our ED class in particular, because I have a feeling that's a big part of that picture.
I can answer that. I receive every suspension form and read the comments and why the suspension. And some of them are through assessment identification, so they're in the assessment process when they are suspended, and it is because of the impulse control or the behaviors that have escalated and it caused the suspension. It goes into assessment, their special education, finding that they're ADD, ADHD, or there is some of the students with other disabilities, such as the ED, that may not be in the ED class. Some of them are defiance of behaviors, and we're working. That's the percentage gets high when we look at it like this. They're also that's when they're triggers for behavior support plans as well.
And so you see it drop down then in middle and high school, but at the elementary, when they're just beginning to present some behaviors and being assessed, that's accounts for at least a part of that higher number.
Right, and that early intervention is so critical, and it shows the evidence here, too.
Thank you.
One other thing that I was asked to look into was the years and look at this longitudinally. we're usually, and again, each high school is a little different, we're usually in that ballpark, in that low 50s to high 50% of graduating seniors meeting the minimum requirements to get into a UC or CSU school. And one of the questions I was talking to Mr. Buckman earlier today was, is that good? Is that bad? You know, what? How does that compare? And that's an interesting question, because if you were to look at our similar schools, so every year when we get our API scores, we get a listing of 100 similar high schools. So we can look at Morro Bay High School and look at all the different schools that are considered similar in terms of demographics and school size and population So I did that. I looked at a few of those similar schools, even within our own county. Templeton High School, for example, is on the 100 similar schools rank for both Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo High School, which kind of surprised me. But their rate was 45%. If you look at a school like Pacific Grove High School, which is also on the similar school ranking of Morro Bay High School, their rate is 93%. I came from what I thought was a powerhouse high school in Southern California 16 years ago, had lots of advanced placement classes, an international baccalaureate program, you know, graduated about 800 students a year out of the school. Their score, and they're a similar school to San Luis Obispo High School, and their score was 42% graduating seniors meeting the requirements. So I don't know if 52 is good or bad. I would say it's not good enough. It would seem that in a district like ours, we would want to have a higher percentage of our seniors meeting those requirements. Yes.
You were in high school 16 years ago?
Oh, man. working at one. So if you look at the ethnicity of that... yeah, there you go. This is largely a white population. However, if you look at Asian students, African American students, that whole other amalgamation, it's pretty represented proportionally. I mean, the proportions of students meeting these requirements is pretty much, you know, across the board, except once again, Hispanic Latino students. Last year, 7% of our Hispanic population qualified for the UC-CSU minimal requirements, and yet Hispanic students made up 21% of our graduating class. So it's a, again, falling below what our expectations would be if we tried to hold our true demographic with everything.
Do we have a sense of how ABID impacts those percentages?
Well, that's an interesting thing, too, and I don't know. I know that every student in the ABID program at Morro Bay High School, 2 years running, have been able to go to a four-year college. So those are students who are their generation of are in ABID because they're coming from a family background that has not had access college, and they are not all Hispanic students. Their qualifications for ABID, you know, are kind of different at the two programs, but we're seeing great success. They're obviously meeting the UC-CSU requirements. EL and special ed students largely don't meet these requirements. I mean, we do have the outlier EL student or special ed student. Those would be special ed students who are mainstream most of their school day, because our specific EL classes, our specific EL English or reading classes are not UC-CSU A through G classes. Our specific special education classes are not approved by the regents, and so we have some, you know, very few students meeting those requirements that are in those groups. What we don't have here in any of this data I share with you is socioeconomic data. How are our low SES students doing in all of these categories, suspensions, expulsions, UC? And we can get that now that we have data director. One of the tricky parts about the SES group, the low socioeconomic group, is that we don't have access to those students by name, because up until this point, those students are qualified by their free and reduced lunch status, and we don't get to know who those individual students are. We get to know what the aggregate number is, but we're working on that. So what are some conclusions? Right. I want to remind you what I said at the beginning. Yes.
I had one question. Are we able to also, I noticed a school accountability report card, while I was at the conference,
we're able to see how kids are doing when they go to the UC or CSU. So are we able to see how many of our students are enrolled in remedial classes? Do we have that data yet? Remedial math?
Yeah, I think it is on our CSU. It should be on our SARC report.
Oh, it is on ours. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I want to remind you, we have 1 year of reliable data. It's hard to draw trends. It's hard to draw conclusions. And so, you know, I think we need to be careful with it. It's certainly a question we can ask. Mr. Millar.
I don't want to disrupt the presentation, but one of the questions I had here do we do in-service training for site administrators, deans, principals, so that they're... The difficulty I have with this question is it has to do with is their consistency in how they approach disciplinary issues and when expulsions. And I know we have board policy and ARs. And the difficulty with asking this is, of course, we're supposed to be tailoring our disciplinary response to the individual student and the individual
right.
needs of that student.
Right.
So I guess the first part of the question is, do we try to give some parameters to staff so that there is some consistency to the extent that there should be some?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think we do. I think we have some consistency, but as you see it in expulsion hearings, you see different administrators bring students forward to expulsion with different types of recommendations. So obviously, it is not uniform. If you were to look at the number of suspensions at our schools, proportion elementary schools, middle schools, high school, proportionate to their student population, you're going to see different numbers. So, part of it might be the school culture, but I think that it's probably an area we need to focus on. We need to look at is more consistency. In fact, I got an email today from one of our high school principals wanting that to be part of a next principal's meeting to discuss kind of the consistency with some of our rules and regulations. So we probably have some work to do in that area. That's really it. Probably this whole idea of suspension of special education students is something to look at. And the correlation of this data with other data sets. One of the nice things about Data Director and about, I think, our heightened focus on data is that we should be able to start looking at other items that we know contribute to this. Truancy rates, school transiency rates. I mean, you often see when they come to you, students who are coming for expulsion who haven't been in our school district for many years. They might have been in many school districts. And being able to use our socioeconomic disadvantage subset as a group of students to look at. So, again, probably more questions than we have answers for tonight. So I'm available for questions and comments and lack of knowledge as you see fit. Yes.
First of all, thank you very much. I think it's informative and somewhat disturbing. And I'd say that with regard to your remarks about the suspension and expulsion data, I, for one, would like to see us continue. I understand the difficulty in going back, and I don't see the need. I mean, it would be wonderful if it were an easy task, but I appreciate the difficulty. So I would say what I would like to do is go forward and maybe add some additional information, such as the socioeconomic status. I don't know how difficult it would be to break out some of the overlap between EL and Hispanic, you know, some of those subsets.
Shouldn't be difficult.
Okay, I'd like to see some of that because I think it would give a little bit of truer data. I haven't been on the board very long, but I think one of the things I've really noticed at our expulsion hearings that I look closely at is something you touched on, and that's time in our district. We see students who have changed schools. By the time they're in our high school, they may have gone to school in 7 or 8 different districts. They may have a chaotic living situation where they're going between parents and then to grandparents and then into another state and then back to us. And I know we can't, there's a only so far we can drill down, but we see some of that information. Sometimes we have a high school student we only see a little bit of information on because it doesn't even exist. We don't have a record that's followed that child. So, and then I would also ask that Dr. Prater share this information with the principals because I think it provides an opportunity for reflection on some of this information, the suspensions. I appreciate very much the fact that these early suspensions may trigger that need for intervention and may be the starting point, which is Marilyn pointed out, perhaps is the reason why those numbers actually go down later on or higher so early on. But I think this is
on a future agenda, but it's more general.
Dr. Prater, would you like to go next, or would you like Mr. Angel to go next?
Phil, why don't you go ahead?
No, I'm going to say I appreciate the data as well. One of the things I'm cautioning myself at looking at it, I probably had some awkward faces there when I was looking at the data, but we need to make sure we look at our data in conjunction with our past data, which we can't do right now, but we'll start trending it, how we're doing against other districts and how we're doing against the state, the county, and whatnot. It'd be also nice to see the different school breakdowns, but I don't think the board needs to see that. I think maybe you guys would want to see that.
Thank you.
You know, I appreciate the work you did there, Rick, and I would like to reiterate that this is just the beginning of, and one of the things I wanted to say with respect to this presentation is I've heard some peripheral dialogue about the perils of focusing on achievement data, and that focusing on the STAR data as problematic in education because it's focused on outcome-based education and we lose sight of the whole child. And I believe that what you saw tonight up there on the board is just the beginning of a much more complex picture of what we need to do next. And so will I share this data with the principals? You bet. Will the data fields that we'll develop become richer and deeper over time? Absolutely, because I believe that STAR data taken by itself is truly problematic. But when you build your data sets and you build a more clear picture of what is going on with education in our community, what you'll begin to see are holes in our program of support for kids. You'll begin then to be able to respond more properly and more in a more targeted, precise fashion when you have this data field in front of you that says, here is what's going on in our district. These are the things we seem to be doing well with. Here are some real big problems that we're going to have to confront. And the core of that is building awareness through this data. You build awareness with the people in this district, I would argue, are some of the finest people I've ever worked with. The problem is not everyone's clear on what the problem is. So my job, as I see it, is to build a very clear picture using data fields that challenge us to ask those deeper, more penetrating questions. Do we have a staff that has been properly trained and developed in the areas of cultural competencies? Do we have a staff that has been properly trained on best instructional practices to reach out and engage all of our kids? I absolutely believe that we are on the right track, but we have got to roll up our sleeves and I think build a defense against some of the arguments that are traditional in our community and in our society, which is woe to outcome-based education. I would say woe to outcome-based education if you're only going to use a single measure. Use multiple measures as your guide and then engage all of us to our full capacity for our kids. And I know that we can do it, but we can't be afraid of the data. We have to embrace it and make great decisions based on it. And that's what I wanted to say. That's where we're going.
Okay. Any other comments? Any comments from the audience? I think the lesson here is that this is really formative data for the school district as opposed to summative data for the school district. And we're going to be using data to learn the things that we need to learn to be a better, more effective district. And I think that what I heard from the board is that they want continuing updates on this and they want to continue to be engaged in these discussions. Go ahead. Hi, Mary Jo. Come on down.
Thank you. Mary, is it on? Okay, thank you. Mary Jo Devitt, San Luis Obispo. Very impressive. Very impressive. When Dr. Prater first came and I had met him a few times, I spoke to him personally, one-on-one, and I said, Dr. Prater, I hope you find us to be who we are and not who we think we are. And I shared this with Mr. Robinette the other day, and actually it was yesterday. And after a couple of years, our children had been gone before I even started this. And so this young man comes to the gate, and if they had a black and gold pass or something, that was simple. But then if they had like some kind of school pass or whatever, student, they had a sticker, and every year the color changes. So this young man comes to the gate, and he has a red sticker and it's supposed to be blue. And so I said, I'm sorry, you need to go and buy a ticket. You can't be admitted with this pass because it isn't valid. And he said, do you have children at the school? And I said, no, and kind of just went briefly through it. And he said, well, actually, I'm Rick Robinette, the new assistant principal. So I thought he was a student that was trying to get through. Well, it was the first year you were here. I don't know how long ago it was, but, he had on a black sweater. And, I just thought, here's one of these darn kids trying to get through. But at any rate, thank you very much, Dr. Prater. I'm very impressed, and those people who know me know that I give about 6 compliments a year, and it's December. So thank you so much. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Still with a baby face, Mr. Robinette.
Yes.
Thank you, Mary Jo. It's good to see you. We're glad you're back. We've missed you. So let's move on to item number 5, which is the negotiations reopener proposals from the California School Employees Association, Chapter 89, and this is a public hearing. Mr. Robinette.
Yeah, we actually have to do 2 public hearings in a row. One is to sunshine the CSEA request to enter into negotiations, which we actually have scheduled for next Thursday, and the second public hearing will be to sunshine the board's interest in entering into negotiations.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and open the public hearing for item number 5. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak to item number 5? Seeing no one, I'll close that public hearing. Let's move on to item number 6, the Board of Education's negotiations proposals for California School Employees Association, Chapter number 89. Mr. Robinette, I think you explained that pretty well before, so I'm going to go ahead now and open the public hearing for item number 6. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak to item number 6? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing for item number 6. We'll move on to item number 7, which is resolution number 091011. Positive certification of adequate funding, first interim report for 2010-11, as of October 31st, 2010. Ms. Lang.
Big mic.
Okay, am I on? I'm on. I'll fit all this. Okay, the third PowerPoint for the evening. I just really wanted to use the pointer. It's at that time of the year when we present our first interim financial report. And really this serves 2 purposes. One is to report the district's financial status as of October 31st. And also, it gives the board an opportunity to approve all the transfers that have occurred since budget adoption in June. And some of the reasons that we do these budget transfers are we budget our carryover in our expenditure items. We have a lot of unknowns that happen after we pass the budget. When the state budget is enacted, it often changes our budget. And we also have normal program and personnel changes that occur. Our unrestricted carryovers have been budgeted. The school site carryovers amounted to about $330,000, and this is for things like donations and MAW money and mandated costs, energy rebates. We also had about $58,000 in department carryover, which are library donations, ALT, CASI, any kind of unrestricted state or local revenues that come in that departments are allowed to carry over. And the flexible resources, those are all those that used to be restricted and they're now unrestricted, but we're still accounting for them in separate resources, and we carry them over so that we can use them in future years. Those carryovers amounted to $457,000. And then our handful of restricted programs that are left, like EIA, ELAP, the ARA money, that's the SFSF money, and Medi-Cal billing and restricted lottery, we budgeted $808,000. And you can see all these, I get to use the pointer here, these little negatives here mean that that's the effect it has on our ending balance. And
couple of quick questions.
Yeah.
Unrestricted.
They continue adjusting that throughout the year, so that may change a little bit as we get on with the year. We made some special ed bus purchases. Most of that was actually spent out of ARA funds, but because they weren't exclusively for special ed students, we also paid for part of it out of our transportation budget. And a couple of our employee units agreed to the attendance incentive payout. That was $772,000 that we budgeted. And then $18,000 in regular adjustments to the budget. The changes due to the state budget were actually both in our favor. They eliminated the per ADA reduction that we thought we were going to get hit with, and so we were able to put that back in the budget. And we also should be getting some mandated cost reimbursements, and we estimated that at about $24 per student, which came out to about $187,000. Oh, did I skip one? Maybe not. Okay, this is your general fund summary.
Skip one.
I don't know if I skipped it or not, but I can't get back to it. this is our general fund summary. This is on page 7.4 in your agenda if you want to follow along in there. And you can see here that this compares our adopted budget with our first interim budget. Our total revenues went up by about $2.3 million, mainly due to that federal jobs money that we budgeted in federal and also that state money that the deferral, exactly, the reduction that they didn't end up taking.
Is it fair to say that the increase in revenues is in a major part due to one-time monies?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, the federal jobs money is one-time, has to be spent by the end of next year.
Jackie's going to save
you back. Without the one-time money, we would be actually much closer to our adopted budget. We'd be about $2 million less. Is that right?
Oh, no, I have to go forward again.
That's okay. I don't mean to screw things up there.
Well, that's correct, yeah. Okay. We'd be much closer to our estimated adopted budget.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I can go. There we go. I got it. Thank you. Going back again. The other budget changes that we made were for normal personnel and program changes. We always have to balance our contribution in our indirect cost accounts. If you recall, at budget adoption, we only budgeted 80% to the sites for their allocations. We increased that to 100%. There were some programs that we didn't budget in budget adoption that we still needed to budget for, so things like the special ed autism transition and also the drug and alcohol contract that used to be paid out of Title IV and we're no longer receiving Title IV funds. So we had to increase the budget for that. And then when we increase the expenditure counts, we also have to increase our 10% for economic uncertainty. So that was increased by about $348,000. Okay. All right. Back to this. Our expenditures, as you can see, also went up. The carryovers, for the most part, are budgeted in materials and supplies. We received donations for things like field trips and assemblies, so that's mainly budgeted in these operations and other, so that went up. The capital outlay that went up was due to the bus purchases that we made. So if you take the total revenue and you subtract the total expense, we have $408,000 positive balance. But that doesn't include our transfers. We have a transfer in of $300,000. That's from Fund 20 for the post-retirement benefits, post-employment benefits. And we have $1,500,000 transfer out, and that's for the adult ed program. So if you take that $408,000, you add the $300,000 that's coming into the general fund, and you take out the $1,500,000 that's going out of the general fund, we end up with a net decrease to the general fund of $792,000. And that's subtracted from our beginning balance, leaving an ending balance of about $22 million. And then from that, we have to subtract all our components of the ending fund balance. That includes the 10% for economic uncertainty, which we have adjusted for the adjustments in our expenditure accounts. And all these other subtotals, we have our restricted balances. We still have some reserve in there. We have our flexible resource balances that has reserves and our one-time revenues and the subtotal for the lottery and other. And that leaves an unappropriated ending fund balance of $3 million. So if we continue with the program, we'll end up getting more revenues, but we're going to have more expenses too because we'll have to decrease those class sizes back down. So overall, our salaries, we budgeted a little bit more here, and that's because of the K-3 class size reduction. Otherwise, the salaries only include step and column and a slight decrease for expected retirements. The benefits, we increased health and welfare by 8% in both years. Decreased materials and supplies because we're going to have a reduced budget because of the ARRA and the federal money that's going away. And overall, you can see that at the end of 2012-13, we still end up with a positive balance, which means we will get a positive certification. And
that positive certification comes about in part because of the 10% reserve on economic uncertainty.
Yes. Well, positive certification is if you can meet your obligations, your financial obligations, in the current year and the next 2 years.
Right.
Maintain
including the statutory reserve.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So we keep hearing about the future, and they keep saying to prepare for the worst and hope for the best, and it seems like the best keeps getting further and further away from us. Our current year state budget has a gap of $6 billion. They're expecting that to be an additional $19 billion next year. Our new governor is going to inherit the largest deficit in the history of any state in the nation. So we expect that by second interim, things are going to look very different, and we could actually see some mid-year cuts again. And with that, I could open it up to questions or comments.
I just have one. If anybody wanted to follow, we can go back to 7.4. But I always find the lottery money interesting. And ever since, it seems to me, we've approved the lottery over the objections of several of us, that it actually is going down, or it fluctuates so much.
The amount?
Yes.
Actually, it's going up a little bit.
Not by my choice. I mean, that, I'm not spending money.
Oh, right, right. Actually, schools are going to get a little bit higher percentage of lottery than they have in the past, I think, beginning this year. But the reason this went down is because this is our ending balance that we projected at budget adoption, and this is only this year's estimated revenues. We don't ever know what we're going to get, so we may get more than that.
So I guess now that I've opened this can of worms, can you tell us roughly what percent of our budget lottery?
It's about 1%.
Okay, just so everybody understands.
Yeah.
It didn't save the day.
No. No, it didn't save the day. It helped. Didn't save the day.
And, Julie, are we still budgeting lottery money after we receive it a year later?
Correct. Yes, so we're spending last year's money this year.
Yeah, we don't guess.
And this 860 is we're keeping in reserve, and that's what we expect to get this year.
And I think one of the things that we as a board paid a lot of attention to at our school board's conference was the projections for the future. And Russell, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we're looking at a minimum of about 300. Revenue limit districts are looking at about $300 less per ADA. And depending on how the state chooses to address the budget, it could be as much as $600 per ADA is what I recollect hearing. I suspect that we're going to feel our fair share of the pain. And I don't know how that's going to look, but I think we need to be prepared for the future. And again, what I'm seeing is a lot of what we're looking at as increases in our revenue is one-time revenues, and we need to continue to treat those very carefully.
Yeah, I would agree with your assessment. I'd even throw out that the $1.5 million relief that we experienced when the budget was finally passed by the state is actually going to reoccur as a minimum. So we will have a fair share of pain of $1.5 million or more. And we will know about that whenever the state's probably the new governor takes office and concludes the emergency session of the budget the legislature called for the purpose of addressing the budget shortfall.
Right. And I think one of the things that I've read is the deferrals may not even be paid back, so that that may just be a write-off, and that would hurt school districts even more.
You know, yeah, and that's even more impactive in a negative sense than cutting a revenue limit, and it'll happen before the end of the school year.
In the audit, it shows a 14% reserve, and this we're showing a 10% reserve. Can you explain that to me?
Good question. And but what it is that they measure our reserves in a different way than we're presenting them. They measure the available reserves as a combination of the 10% economic uncertainty and the $3.5 million that's down at the bottom as undesignated reserves. Everything else they're designating as purposeful, and so we have a use for that money. Now, theoretically and practically, we've reserved these monies for various reasons. With the restricted programs that turned unrestricted, we want to continue to identify that amount of money that we took from each of those programs and turned it into unrestricted money, because maybe, we don't know, the state may tell us we have to pay it back. And how do we account for it if we haven't identified it? So what we've done is we've made it a reserved amount. And then, and we tap into it. Like adult ed, we got $1.4 million up there. And when we have to fund them above and beyond what the state pays, we tap into their reserves that we took. And so we're giving it back as needed basis, but we're still identifying it for a purpose. And the auditors look on that as not being available for any purpose.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to this item? Okay, Mr. Buckman, would you like to go ahead and move the resolution?
Yes.
Do we do this in action consent, Kim, or is this is a resolution?
This
so
is a resolution.
Yeah. Right. So, Mr. Buckman, did you want to go ahead and make that.
Yeah, I'd like to make the motion to approve resolution number 09-10-11.
And I'm looking, as seconded by Mr. Millar. Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Angel?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Passes 6-0.
Move on to item number 8, approval of resolution number 10-10-11 in support of full state funding of county mental health services for children with disabilities. Jackie?
No PowerPoint, but you get my passion. In 1984, our previous Governor Brown had proposed funding for students with special needs to receive mental health services should they require it through their IEP, funding associated with it. This is also a federal mandate. Our governor currently vetoed that funding line and took away that money. It left chaos. We are currently in chaos. We have no services for students newly identified requiring mental health services, those students that have IEPs that require mental health services. There's over 20,000 students in California right now requiring mental health services through their IEP, and the money is gone. He stopped the money, and we have students who are in non-public schools, requiring those services. Mental health provides therapy, therapeutic services. The Sente treatment program is also coordinated with the funding of mental health and the school districts. So when you take away that funding, it leaves the responsibility to the school districts to provide those services. How do we provide those services? We have to dip into the general fund. Because special education must encroach if it's not funded through the state. So we are asking you to look at this resolution and request that the governor and the state change this funding model back to full funding. It was never fully funded, but at least give the funding line back into the budget. Students that are in LA Unified, what the county mental health did down there is they stopped the services immediately. Our local county mental health has not done that. They've said the students that are receiving services right now, we will continue to serve on a 30-day interim, and those students that need those services right now, you're going to have to try and support the DA population, $4 per child per ADA, which accounts for about $27,000 that this school district will need to pay for the rest of this school year if the state does not, or the governor, the new governor, does not reinstate the funding. That's not a crisis for us, but it is if the small school districts have 5 or 6 students, that could be quite a bit of money that they're not able to support their students. In the meantime, right now, we have a couple students that are not able to access county mental health services, and we've had to look at other avenues. We don't want our students to go unserved, so we've looked at licensed clinical psychologists to help support those students in the interim. We're developing the memorandum of understanding. It goes to the Board of Supervisors, and once that occurs, then we can have county mental health start supporting our students again. It's been very collaborative, and we've been in a good situation through our county, but LA Unified and Torrance, and along with some of the private attorneys have filed a civil lawsuit against the state and against the governor himself. So I'm available to answer any questions, but I ask that you look at the resolution and hopefully approve this resolution tonight. I gave you a lot of information because it's something that just is not right.
The School Boards Association Legal Alliances sued the governor and the governor's office, claiming that his action was unconstitutional, and we expect to be hearing about that soon as well.
Absolutely.
What Jackie says is absolutely true. It will be difficult for small school districts. It will be difficult for kids that are expensive and who require a lot of services. Kids that maybe can't be served in this county and that need to be placed out of county in order to get what they need. Somebody's going to have to be able to pay for that. And if we can't collaborate with county mental health, we're not sure how it's going to happen. It's a very serious situation. And I would encourage everybody to support this and that we go forward with it.
County mental health are the experts to help support these specialized students in conjunction with the schools.
Exactly.
I'll move approval of resolution number 10-10-11.
I'll second it just with the wanting to say, what is it with these actor governors and their take on the mental health people?
Any other discussion? Is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to this item? Okay, seeing them, Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mr. Angel?
Aye.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Aye.
Passes 6-0.
Let's move on to item number... Oh, gosh. I think we're at item number 9. Back to Julie Lang.
That'll be me.
Oh, Russell, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she did the work, but I have to present it. So
she did all the work, and you get the glory.
No, this isn't glory. I have to subject myself to your guys' questions. Okay. Developer, this is an item designed to talk about the accounting for our developer fees. Developer fees are established under government code that we can charge a certain amount per square foot of new and remodel construction, and we do so at the rate of $2.97 per square foot. I'm sorry, our amounts are $2.63. The state would allow us to go to $2.97. The fees are levied so that when they do new funding, they do new construction or remodels, the thinking is that will create capacity in a school district by having new kids enroll. The summation of the numbers are such that $7.8 million is in our capital facilities fund, which accounts for developer fees. We had revenues of $327,000. We did some minor expenditures of $31,000. We have an ending balance of $8,076,000 at June 30th, 2010. Our rate of revenues is down considerably, as you would imagine, over some peak years that exceeded $1 million. But this is probably going to be normal for the next several years.
Questions for Mr. Miller? Seeing no questions, I don't think this is an action item.
No action item, just information only.
Okay. Great. Is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to this item? Okay. Seeing no one, let's move on to item number 10, additional new secondary courses for 2011-12. Ms. Dulkiskamp.
Students signing up for one particular one, so they combine them. And so what happens sometimes is that a student might sign up for any one of those medals one, and because there aren't enough students, it won't be combined into that class. So the purpose of the first two courses on your list is to combine some of those skills and knowledge and aptitudes within one course. So instead of trying to offer that course with three different course outlines, there's one course outline that combines introductory units for wood or energy, electronics, metals, auto, and engineering all in one course. And in that way, it more comprehensively prepares this group of students and doesn't leave one of those electives out, instead combines them. And so the second one, engineering concepts, just takes that beginning introductory course to another level. And then these, of course, can lead to some of our capstone ROP courses. So that's the purpose behind those two. Shall I pause for a question on that before I go on? Okay. The last course on there was initiated at San Luis Obispo High School, and the need that they're trying to address is that, I don't know where these kids get their brains, but we have some really smart kids who, as sophomores and juniors, complete AP Calculus AB. Okay, and so for their junior and senior year, they would like to take some more calculus. And we currently don't offer this course, AP Calculus BC. We've got about 40 to 50 students who would like to do that instead of traveling to Cuesta College or trying to pick up the course somewhere else. And so we'd like to meet that need by offering this course. So we've discussed and reviewed these courses with our school staff, with our curriculum council members and district staff, and so on their behalf, I present them to you for approval either at this meeting or the next.
Anybody from the public that would like to comment or have questions? Mr. Buckman, I'll bet you'd like to make a motion.
Do you have a question?
Oh,
go ahead.
This looks great, Rita, and it's the feeder into the ROPs that attracts me, as well as the calculus, which I never would have been able to take. The two classes that we're proposing in industrial tech, are they A to G qualified? And
they're elective credit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Applied arts.
Right.
Okay, graduation requirement.
And part of this, the CTE strand.
Yes.
Okay. I would like to make a motion to approve this item. Thank you.
So that motion, do we have a second? I'll second. Mrs. Scheffer seconds it.
The motion was made by Mr. Buckman and seconded by Mrs. Scheffer. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like to pull an item. Item number 11, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Item number 12, acceptance of donations. Item number 13, disposition of surplus property. 14, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 15, approval of purchase orders. 16, approval of warrants and payroll. 17, acceptance of audit report. Seeing that none has been pulled, and is there anybody from the public that would like to speak to this? And seeing no one, I'd like to hear a motion, please.
I'll move approval of items 11 through 17. Record.
Somebody like to second that?
Second.
Okay, it's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Angel. All in favor?
Aye.
Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 19, advanced agenda. Is there anyone that has any items they would like to add to the advanced agenda? Mr. Angel.
Not necessarily advanced agenda, but Friday update, executive summary of tonight's PowerPoint from Rick. And little board education on A through G requirements.
Okay. Is that acceptable for a Friday packet for everybody? Okay. All right. Let's move on to item number 20, reports by board members. I know we all had some pretty cool week last week and learned a lot of stuff. Does anybody have anything they'd like to report at this time?
Yeah. I just want to mention that I've been sitting on the Anti-Gang Commission –